Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole deck with galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds, for whatever you love. Infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
From athletic stuff like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully everybody's doing well. I know that we've all been pretty busy. I've been hunting quite a bit. I've had some success, and I'll save my podcast for that later on. But we're going to get back into it with Dieter Kalkin and talk a lot more about his specific rut strategy, handling pressure deer, hunting the big woods, really dialing into scrapes, human odor. I explained a lot on how I evaluate human odor and its significance on the landscape, and Dieter adds some of his points of view. So appreciate everybody listening, and here's part two. Are you one of these hunters that finds those pinch points and you know, sits on that pinch point day in and day out and hope that animal comes, you know, down that corridor at some point? Or are you trying to just find where the doe activity is during the breeding period? Like, what is your strategy? How does it evolve? And do you have any specific deer that you think you could be more dialed on this year because of an approach that you have? Do you go after a breeding location? Do you go after a transition location? And how are you diagnosing a little bit that when you're making an approach here to trying to kill a more mature deer, whether it's a 3, 4, 5, 6, 10-year-old deer?
I
definitely mix it up. I mean, there's spots, you know, rut funnel type spots that are worth just camping out in and sitting all day. And then there's other spots where, you know, they're probably really good in the morning and then through the midday, but they might not be that great right in the evening. And that was one of the big things that I noticed when I was just kind of like cataloging, okay, you know, go back to the last however many bigger deer that I shot, when was I shooting them? And it was like it was like 70-80% I was shooting in the morning or like midday. And what that told me was, okay, you know, I've got those kinds of spots figured out, but I might as well make a move for that last couple hours of prime time and sit like a destination area, because I'm really not getting anything out of these spots, you know, once I get past 1-2 o'clock. So I'm willing to mix it up. You know, sometimes, especially out of state, you know, I could be hunting swamps, I could be hunting hill country, just a mix of a lot of different things. And I've always tried to be more well-rounded. And I was actually, you know, a while ago, I think I was shooting all my deer in the evening. And then I kind of started looking at things differently, how I was hunting my mornings. And a lot of that ended up transitioning into using a gray light access compared to previously I'd been, you know, trying to get to these locations an hour or two before first light. And what was happening was I ended up spooking so many deer on the way in that it ended up becoming counterproductive. And I learned that if I used more of a gray light access and I was able to kind of, you know, work my way in slowly and be able to actually kind of see deer off in the distance, they kind of looked like almost like blobs or hay bales. You couldn't really tell exactly what they were, but it looked like something. And you'd be able to let those kind of get out of the way, especially with like a field type access where you could see a further distance. So getting to my stands a little bit later, I wasn't spooking anything. And then, you know, a short while after getting situated my tree, then the deer would start filtering through again. So just kind of changing how I access different areas. Because if you're spooking deer, I mean, that's not a good thing. If you can do something different that's not going to spook them, I mean, you might as well try it. And it ended up being a huge tactic for me. And during the season for me ends up being a grind to some degree. I mean, it's, yeah. if you can stick it out and stay positive and stay motivated, your chances for success are way higher. And if you look at even, let's say you get a week to 2 weeks off, if you're able to save an hour to 2 hours of sleep every morning by accessing in gray light, you're going to be way sharper, way more motivated. You're probably not going to sleep in and entirely skip a morning hunt. You're going to stay after it. And I think, you know, being able to grind and being able to have confidence is a huge asset, because if you're not confident in what you're doing, you're not going to be paying attention to the same level. And then when you do finally get an opportunity, you might not be ready for it. You might be on your phone or not paying attention, or maybe asleep in your tree. But, you know, I, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I guess I've always kind of prided myself on the ability to grind it out. And I wish I was better at getting it done in the first couple of days, like some guys are. But for me, right, it seems like it just ends up being, I'm more of a marathon guy than a sprinter, I guess.
Yeah. By choice or by situation, right? That's part of the issue. You know, it's funny. I was thinking about like these scenarios. I've got this one area that I've hunted. It's always a grind getting there in the mornings, and I've come in at 3 a.m., and this is where the cameras tell the tale. Like, deer use certain areas a certain. Usually use that as my means to figure out when to extract deer that I kill, as well as when I had access an area. So I try to put like a general trend together. And then there's these anomalies or deer are cruising through areas and you can't always predict, you know, everything they're going to do. And then I've had situations where I bump, make sure I bump deer off fields, come back hours later to get access. And I've done gray light scenarios where I'm coming in gray light, but I've got to change my route because again, I get a lot of transition in and out certain areas during that gray light period. So for every spot within the spot or spot that you're trying to access, you could have all these different strategies to get into those locations. Some maybe you have to sleep underneath the tree stand. Some maybe you have to sleep in the tree stand. And so, you know, it's just like part of the grind process. And I'm not suggesting people do that. It could be a safety thing. Maybe in a box blind, that's fine. Or, you know, you dig yourself a little hole in the ground underneath your stand and you can hide and just throw a bunch of leaves over you. But I mean, if you're thinking about, you know, just investing time into something, you don't want to waste your time. And that's the biggest thing. When you go and bump deer, that's the first thing you do. I mean, was this a complete waste? And I've had certain hunts where, you know, I've bumped deer and I've been still successful. But to your point, you know, it's not something that I want to do. And I can't minimize that all the time. And even the best designers or the best people that are working on property design or layout, any land manager, person, et cetera, you know, you can't foolproof everything. There's always going to be errors in your ways and approach. And I think knowing that and realizing it, it's just like, you don't want to put too many of those negative scenarios in your hand, in your card deck. And you want to be able to play certain cards a certain time. So I kind of like with you 100% on this. And I don't like the idea of hunting feeling like a marathon, but you know, last year I hunted so much. It was kind of like a drug addiction. And I just almost, I hate the grind because I go through this whole like regime of clothing management, boot management, hygiene. It's literally, it dries me out. It stresses me out. It makes me lose weight and it's a little bit not fun. And then we get to the hunting piece of it where I'm very tactical and strategic about it. You start to lose your mind a little bit because it's like, and this is why I have a lot of envy for folks that really are dialed in and they have like really strong mindsets is like, you can punch through all that stuff. And I found myself having to punch through it and then almost being addicted to the process. And that just put me on deer every single day because I could tell you where this deer was going to be when, and I was following deer and then I was getting ahead of them and I was having successes in those scenarios. But I think that relates to a lot of what you're talking about, but you're hunting areas that have low deer populations. So, you know, the deer's movement may be a little bit more extreme in distance. It may be hard to dial a deer specifically. So when it comes to like some of your other strategies during the rut, like how do you dial in on some of the unknowns, like the things that you can't fully appreciate and understand? And, you know, knowing what a deer does every second is pretty impossible. Although there's people that are now taking drones up and they're studying them all day and trying to relate to that to some biology and scientific standard of analysis, which is really, like I said earlier, it's pretty specific to your area. You come do that in other areas of the country, you're going to get a totally different result. But again, I just want your take on just, you know, your approach.
Yeah, Michigan, I mean, my strategy is, you know, there's a couple layers to it. I think, you know, I have a handful of spots that have been successful that I definitely end up spending some time in, but it ends up being like the more information you can accumulate to help you make a decision, the better off you're going to be. And that kind of goes to, you know, a bunch of different things, whether that's the e-bikes where you can check 10 cameras instead of one camera, and just overall efficiency. So a lot of my spots in Michigan are set up to where, you know, the access is almost more important than the spot. And part of it is that the access is kind of set up to check, you know, one to two cameras on the way in. So then if I hunt a particular location, and in most of my spots, I can't even use cell cameras. So it might be different for a lot of different people if you have the ability to use cell cameras. But if I can check two cameras on the way into my tree, then I have three times as much information to make, you know, that next correct decision. I have the information off those cameras I checked, and then I have the information from what I saw that evening. So just kind of trying to put things odds in your favor with making the right decision. I think that's the big, you know, cameras are the easiest way to do that. I think, you know, prior to cameras, it was more woodmanship where you're, you know, interpreting tracks and different sign. But regardless of how you're doing it, the more information you can take in, the better. If you had the choice to, and it has to be a tactical approach, obviously, but I mean, if you have the choice to walk 50 yards to get to your tree or 150 yards to walk to your tree, and that 150 yards is tactically better, and you're able to accumulate way more information on the walk in, I think, you know, over the course of the year, you're going to make better decisions.
Yeah, I like that. So as you walk in and you're picking, you know, you're picking a camera location, and then you're using that later on in part of your approach, and you're analyzing that. Are you analyzing that at the spot? Are you pulling an SD card? I'm assuming this is a non-cellular camera. You're pulling that information, and are you standing right there to analyze it? Or are you taking that chip and analyzing it, you know, in the stand and making some decisions? Or how does it work along the way most for you when you're, you know, going into the property?
For me, I've already made the decision where I'm going. So, I mean, maybe I could get better intel that would change my thought process, but a lot of it ends up being like, it might not, especially with big woods hunting, like it seems like they're more nomadic. And if you don't see them for a couple days, your chances almost get better that you're going to see them in the next couple days to follow, just because they're not there. It's not Midwest hunting. I think you can overhunt spots where you end up like bumping them out of there, where it seems like with some of the big wood stuff that if you don't see them, they're probably nowhere, you know, there's a good chance that they're nowhere near that area. So that your chances almost get better the more you kind of stick it out. It's kind of a weird dynamic with lower deer densities.
Yep.
Because if you're not spooking even the does or your target buck, and you know it's a good area, and a lot of it ends up being scrape hunting, where over the course of a year, there's probably like a 1 to 2 week window where every decent buck will hit, you know, a certain group of, you know, really productive scrapes that, you know, whether you were able to make them as mock scrapes or they're naturally in that area. But that's kind of the thing I key on in Michigan is, you know, I always have to be near a scrape. There's almost no ag, so there's very little kind of bed to food movement. It's more of a nomadic, patient, you know, find good areas. And those are the type of areas where you asked about, you know, if you're willing to kind of camp out and sit a spot for multiple days. And that's kind of what I end up having to do in Michigan, just because it's such big woods that if you're bouncing around too much, you just end up chasing your tail and running out of time before you're able to figure anything out.
I want to talk a little bit about scrapes. And we talked about this in prior podcasts over the past several years. I know that's a big part of your repertoire or whatever you want to say it is. It's part of your strategy. I know Troy Pottinger, he's a scrape guy. I've talked to other people on this podcast that really focus on scrapes. So what do scrapes mean to you from a social activity standpoint? How do you capitalize on them? Are you generally creating them? Are they created themselves? How do you amplify them? Maybe let's dig in a little bit about scrape, the science of scrapes from your standpoint.
It's definitely different. I mean, if you have scrapes all over the place, they're probably not going to be as valuable. Like in the Midwest, you can walk down a field edge and you might find 30 of them compared to up here. I mean, if I go scouting and I cover 10 miles, you know, I might find one or two. They're just, they're that much more important. And a lot of that is the lower deer densities. So if you can find a good one up here, even though there's less sign and it's somewhat depressing to go out there and scout and not find a bunch of scrapes and a bunch of big rubs, when you do find those kinds of things, they're just that much more important just because they're really limited where they're at. And they're extremely social up here. So like if I make a mock scrape up here, you know, it's going to be in a higher traffic area. It's probably going to be near some preferred food where at least I know I'm holding a doe family group in the area. Cause it seems the bucks are so nomadic that, you know, it's harder to key on just their sign compared to, you know, in some areas, it seems they make what I consider to be just frustration scrapes where they're just so rutted up that, you know, they'll just make like a random scrape here or there. And it really doesn't socially mean a whole lot. And it can be in an area where there's very few does. It could be just right outside of his core bedding area. And he's just making it just because he's all hot and bothered, and he just does it out of frustration compared to, I almost seen no frustration scrapes up here. Like they're all associated with doe travel areas, the intersection of multiple trails, and as hunting spots, they're dynamite up here, and they're good all the way through the late season because they're just the intersection of a lot of different, you know, even subtle habitat features where the deer are telling you that, hey, this is where it's at. And, you know, if you can find those, then they're definitely spots to hunt. I'll also make some mock scrapes, and they'll be close to areas like that. You know, maybe you're trying to pull a little bit of movement or kind of change how a trail goes through a certain area. And sometimes you can get that to work with mock scrapes where, you know, you can put it in an area that's an advantage to you where, you know, you're not going to get winded and you got it set up where they're not going to come from behind you downwind. And, you know, those are the best ones if you can set them up to perfectly fit your needs. But it seems if you can find a natural one, I mean, those are already well established and are going to be used and have been used for many years.
When it comes to doctoring the scrapes themselves, do you have kind of a process there? If anything, the ones that you're self-creating or even amplifying the ones that are, you know, utilized by deer on a normal basis?
Yeah, I'm a buck fever guy. I've had good success with that. I've talked a bunch with Troy Pottinger about it. And I think for my mock scrapes, there's a couple things that I really like about buck fever. One, the forehead gland, I wouldn't necessarily consider it like a true forehead gland. Like it has a curiosity odor to it, which where I put them, that odor is going to draw deer from a greater distance. So if they're going to smell it, be curious, come there, you know, whether it's an immature buck or a doe puts their face in the licking branch, then, you know, there's a high probability that it's going to be taken over by other deer in the area. So I really like the forehead gland just because its ability to draw deer from a little bit further away compared to if I just made it and didn't have something that was a strong odor, they might not find it just because they're not walking right by it, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So I like the forehead gland, and then I like the ground odors that they use for a couple different reasons. One, it crystallizes when it dries out, and you can see this even on, like, if you have a bottle of it and the tops will get clogged and a bunch of different stuff will get clogged because it crystallizes so much. But what that crystallization does is water really reinvigorates it, kind of reenacts it. So there's that benefit. And then there's like a levels of potency where for at least me mentally, it feels like I can kind of build the odors and kind of introduce new odors to try to get the desired reaction would be a buck in daylight. So I'll start them out on the pre-post odor, and I'll run that, this is the green bottle, I'll run that through probably like the week before Halloween, and then right before Halloween I'll switch to the red, which is the rut. And then they also have like two different like red moon, even stronger ones. So once I get into, at the early part of November, I might throw something new at them and see if I can get them kind of fired up with that. And probably the greatest benefit I've seen, whether or not I can say I've directly harvested them because of the buck fever odors, I've never seen a deer like spook or react negatively.
Right.
Whereas I think every so often, like if you use some of these odors, you'll get a deer come there and they'll just completely freak out. And I've never seen that with the buck fever where, at the very least they'll be neutral to it. And in a lot of situations I'll accept neutral. But then you have the added benefit where, I do believe that, you can get them coming a little bit earlier in the day just to kind of check things out.
Well, we've had another guest on here that's talked very similar about their products. So that's a good affirmation that people are using and appreciating those products, on the landscape. I do not use any products, but I'm open. I'm always open to learning. So you two smart guys that are on this podcast have been talking about this. So makes me want to give it a shot. At least I'm used to the old natural kind of a method in some ways, but also, why not try to amplify interest in some of these areas? Like you said, if there's not a negative reaction, can't really, slight it as being non-productive. And if non-productive to me means I'm spooking animals. But then there's the other piece of interfacing with a scrape, not managing your boot scent, just, creating chaos in and around some of those key areas. Is there anything you do to manage boot scent?
I think the best thing you can do is just, take care of your footwear. Like, it doesn't matter if it's rubber, leather, whatever. If you take care of those where you're not introducing a bunch of foreign odors like gasoline or, restaurant odors, different odors like that, you're going to be way better off. I guess a little bit of my background is my real job, I'm a state trooper and I'm in the canine unit. So we train dogs to track people, and the vast majority of the odor is going to be where you walk. So it's going to be ground disturbance odor and then anything that's transferring from your boots. I've seen almost no benefit to rubber over leather.
Yep.
But if you take either of those products, rubber or leather, and then you walk through the gas station, gasoline, diesel odors, we have dogs that'll detect those odors at fire scenes weeks after the fire. So, that's an odor that's going to persist in the environment. It's going to be there for a long time. So if you can just kind of at least eliminate all those super persistent odors, and whether you're using rubber or leather boots, just have those in a tote where they're not getting introduced to these noxious, extremely strong odors, you're going to be way better off. Because whether you use rubber or leather, when you walk over grass, that odor from the crushed ground disturbance can be released into the environment, and the deer are going to be able to smell that area you walked and actually age how long ago that disturbance was created. And then they're going to make a decision whether or not they think they're in any type of danger. So I take care of my stuff. I don't get too crazy. They're always going to be able to smell you no matter what you do. If your odor molecule hits their nose, they're gonna they're going to know you're there, and then they're going to make a decision whether or not they make, whether or not they feel they're in trouble. I think a lot of people think that they had a deer downwind and they didn't smell him for whatever reason. Well, the deer could have easily just smelled you and decided that he was more interested in breeding that doe than he was concerned that you were standing up in the tree. And we've all seen those videos where you have a hunter with a deer, he just shot a doe, and then there's a buck that won't leave, and the guy's standing there right with a gun. So, I mean, they have free will. They're going to make a decision, but I think we can do things that put the odds in our favor, and then obviously utilize the wind to our advantage, thermals, and do whatever we can to make sure that our odor molecules are not coming in contact with their nose.
One of the things, Dieter, I want to add to this, and this has been a strategy with my clients, so this is one of the, you know, design aspects of things, is I want to make sure when you have a trail system that you're walking on, there is vegetation that's persistent in there. So we cut trail systems so vegetation grows. Normally grass would be my preferred because it's the quietest, usually the quietest vegetation to go across. But when you actually walk on that grass, the point you make, you break the cell walls of that plant, and that plant exudes volatile oils, et cetera, that eventually are detectable. The plant itself will admit those. And then your scent on top of that is like a compounding effect. Even more important, and this is why there's science behind, you know, dirt patches or areas where deer are, and when I create beds, I open up these patches so the deer can smell. The thing with dirt is dirt holds on to scent way more persistently for longer periods of time, like that scent that makes contact with that particular dirt. And so vegetation does a better job of masking an odor that may be left there because the plant itself emits odors, if that makes sense. So the combination of those two things, whether it's generating a scrape, that's why a buck clears off a scrape, it creates an open ground so it can emit its odors in that particular area that should persist at a longer period of time, versus having these trail systems that have these kind of luscious, highly activated, and I like wish I could be like, this is why I like the e-bike. You can go in these areas and you're not breaking, you know, the cell walls of those particular plants. There's some value in thinking about that in your design, as well as how deer use the landscape. And you can create environments where you contact more vegetation or less vegetation if you're an animal moving through an area in order to promote, you know, their organic compounds, et cetera, on those orifices or on those vegetation, you know, those plants as it goes through an area. So you may be promoting interest in how you have vegetation within a travel corridor. So it's important to think about all that in design, access, hunting, all these locations. And I mean, these may be pretty, I think, straightforward examples. I think there's quite a bit that can be learned from, you know, your history here as you know, knowing a lot about canines and how they use the landscape and detect things, you know, equivalent to deer in some capacity, maybe not exactly equivalent, but have some, you know, similar attributes, and to how you design a hunting property. A lot of this goes hand in hand. I'm super interested in some of the, again, some of the scrape discussion that you just kind of, you know, talked about. And maybe that's a discussion for another time to understand, you know, the science of scrapes and what we can do to, you know, maybe promote more socialization in and around those without creating disturbance. I'd really like to think about that a little bit more myself.
Yeah, I think some of it is, I mean, recognizing that it's, I mean, why are you making the scrape? Like up in Michigan, it's, you know, this needs to be a socialization scrape. So, I mean, I don't need it to be 6 feet tall. I want some of these younger, immature deer to be able to put their face in it and utilize it. And I think the big thing is the licking branch. I mean, they use kind of, it seems every area has a different preferred licking branch. And up here, it's a balsam fir, and it's kind of a weird licking branch because in most areas you can tell exactly it's a licking branch because they snap it off. And up here, they just kind of gently put their face in it, and it's way less noticeable. Like you have to, you know, kind of interpret it more because it has more to do with the height. And then there's going to be a small scrape on the dirt. But if you have that type of a tree, and originally I was ignoring them, like I had one where I was like, God, that's the perfect height. But you really can't tell much from the licking branch. And then I look at the ground and there's like, it's like the size of a basketball. And I couldn't tell if, you know, maybe it was like a puddle from, you know, when our snow melts. Thinking that, you know, I did everything to convince myself it wasn't a scrape. and then I said, well, I'm putting a camera on it. Cause I was like, it's in the right area, the right height. Looks like the scrape down there. And then sure enough, that camera had every big deer I know about it in, like, you know, a 2 week window was on that, and they were all over it. You know, they're at times up on their hind legs, just gently in the scrape, not really pawing the ground. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out, you know, why they don't utilize the ground as much as deer in different areas.
Is it a little bony? Is it a little more bony in your areas, meaning a lot of roots?
Yeah, there's some roots, and it's like, you know, it's like hemlock, pine forest, and, yep, you know, kind of mixed vegetation. And that definitely could be it. But so it ends up being just that tree species of licking branch. And then as soon as you realize that, you know, if you're walking a deer trail and all of a sudden you come across a tree and it's at that right height, and, you know, chances are that, you know, there's some type of scrape underneath there. So it was more identifying the licking branch than actually, I think in a lot of areas, you're staring at the ground looking for the big car hood size scrape area on the ground compared to, you know, seeking out the preferred licking branch that they're utilizing. Up here, it's, you know, apple trees are always good. If you get an oak, it's good, but it almost has to be perfectly, or not perfectly, but I mean 45 degrees is straight down. Yeah. Those are really good ones.
Yep.
But then these balsam firs, like, the angle doesn't matter. If they're at the right height, they're gonna use it. So that's definitely something to consider.
Yeah, in our area, the predominant species that I focus in on in a forested settings would be hemlock and beech. And it obviously depends on its position in landscape, age class, you know, tree branching structure, those type of things, elevation, all that kind of stuff. And then in the field settings, you know, I've seen autumn olive be a pretty attractive plant, depending how thorny it is, and bush honeysuckle. But when it comes right down to it, white pine, if you can have a white pine in an open setting adjacent to a shrub thicket, and like my favorite areas to hunt, like in some of those settings, typically end up being like a forested wetland in combination with a scrub, kind of like shrubland type area with upland and some peninsulas that are upland within those forested wetlands. Those are like, if you could pick like an ideal cover habitat type that I prefer to hunt, those are the scenarios. And a lot of times when you have those open field settings, if you have white pine stacked in kind of like an accordion style, you can really create this draw movement across the line, and it can be just killer. I usually don't set stands in them, but adjacent to those particular areas can be just killer for scrapes and just general movement. And so now that's kind of what it's like in Central New York. So anybody in Central New York, if you want the little keys and tricks and tactics, those are kind of the species to keep your eye on when it comes to, you know, what locations deer tend to scrape more under than not. And I mean, this is coming after looking at hundreds of properties at this point. So I don't know, you learned a thing or two, and like ignoring the obvious, which sometimes we do, like we talked about. And, you know, the first part here is like the thing that can kill us from making a good decision. And, you know, like I'll put a camera like, oh, that's the spot. And then it's not, you know, it's like, yeah, good thing I ran that other camera over there, because I really missed all those deers and a deer that came through that area. And you have a tendency to do that more often than not. So you almost have to have things checking yourself to make sure you aren't biasing yourself, you know, giving yourself bad information when you're trying to make that, you know, hopefully good decision to go after a deer or to gather intel or, you know, whatever the case may be. Just more thing, food for thought. All right, Dieter, I think we're at the end of this. Hopefully I didn't talk you out too much. So I appreciate all the time. I wish you a ton of luck this season. I have asked every guy that's been on this, and hopefully we do re-attacks. I'd like to hear how the season went right after the season, and shorter podcasts to the point on what did you didn't do, or what did you do, what didn't you do right, and what you learned from the season. And, you know, hopefully, you know, for you, the best of luck and, you know, you kill some of the deer that you're after this year.
Well, thanks. You too. And, I think when you said this is going to air, we're going to be right in the heart of it. So hopefully everybody's out there having fun getting on some deer, and I'll be bouncing around a couple states, and hopefully I can share some grip and grin photos here with everybody coming up.
All right, man. Well, thanks for taking time out of your day, and we'll talk again soon. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel, because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
How many discounts does USAA auto insurance offer? Too many to say here. Multi-vehicle discount, safe driver discount, new vehicle discount, storage discount, legacy.
How many discounts will you stack up? Tap the banner or visit usaa.com/auto discounts. Restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
From lashes for days with the Viral Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara to lift and color from their brilliant eye brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is the go-to for amplifying everyday looks. Plus, every product is 100% vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients that work with your skin. Amplify your everyday. Go to ThriveCosmetics.com/shine26 for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/shine26.